Thank you for coming to this session entitled Thyroid Cancer, Who Really Needs Surgery? We have an exciting program for you. We are going to address three controversial issues on the management of the everyday papillary thyroid cancer. The first one will be the extent of surgery. The second one will be whether we have to do prophylactic central lymph node dissection. And the third gray zone, what to do once we discover persistent or recurrent disease. I am Dimitrios Linos, and I'm professor of surgery from the National and Kapodistrian University of Athens Medical School. And I'm going to moderate. My co-moderator is Dr. Louise Davis. Louise is an associate professor of otolaryngology, head and neck surgery, Geisel School of Medicine, and the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. And we are happy and privileged to have six of the world experts in this field that I hope you can enjoy their talks. And we do invite you at the end of each debate to participate actively. So one will present the cons, the pro side, the other the con, and then at the end of each case scenario, we need your participation. So with that, I will ask Dr. Davis to take the first case.
Okay. So we're starting with the indications and options for the extent of initial surgery. And the options on the table are active surveillance, lobectomy, and total thyroidectomy. We're going to have two people presenting. It's going to be a smackdown. We have Dr. Luke Morris, who's on the head and neck service at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and Dr. Janice Pasica, who is the clinical professor of surgery and otolaryngology. Surgery and oncology. She's a general surgeon. Cummings School of Medicine at the University of Calgary. And we're going to start with the case, and then I will pass it off to Dr. Pasica. So this is a 44-year-old woman who's otherwise healthy. She presents with a 1.4-centimeter solitary nodule. She undergoes a needle biopsy. It shows papillary thyroid cancer. She has no extra thyroidal extension. The clinical exam, as well as the ultrasound, confirms she has lymph nodes that are normal appearing and not palpable. TSH and direct laryngoscopy are both normal. She has no family or radiation history. And we're going to discuss total thyroidectomy or right thyroid lobectomy or active surveillance as our options. I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Pasica.
Well, thank you very much. Maybe we could just take a show of hands. How many people in the audience would offer this patient a total thyroidectomy? And how many would offer her a unilateral lobectomy? And how many would consider active surveillance? Well, Luke, you got your, Luke, you got your work cut out for you. So the overall objectives of our debate is to really highlight the options for low-risk papillary thyroid cancer. And I'm going to be debating the surgical options, which have changed a bit. And my esteemed colleague, Dr. Morris, is going to talk about active surveillance. My own personal objectives here is to go total thyroidectomy versus lobectomy, but I hope by the end of my talk you'll sort of understand that patient selection will be key, and you have to manage your patient's expectations. You have to understand what the local management of papillary thyroid cancer is at your institution, and this has really become a multidisciplinary approach. Really, the treatment of low-risk papillary thyroid cancer is a swinging pendulum. It's gone from total thyroidectomy to thyroid lobectomy and active surveillance, or I like to call it deferred surgery. And why I call it deferred surgery is this recent article by Dr. Maiucci, who really demonstrated that the lifetime risk of disease progression in small papillary thyroid cancers depends on what age you get it. So in your 20s, it could be up to 60% chance you're going to see disease progression. So our patient, it was about 27% chance she's going to progress in her lifetime. Now we know papillary thyroid cancer, everybody says it doesn't cause any mortality, but when we look at the data, thyroid cancer, 2.8% mortality, yes, it's an indolent cancer, but 13% of those deaths were in papillary thyroid cancers that were less than 2 centimeters in size, so people do die of it. What about the quality of life? I think a lot of us were surprised to know that patients experience a lower quality of life than these other cancers, breast cancer, glioma, colon cancer. And they, even though they have a much more indolent biological course. And when they drilled down to try to figure out, well, what was it that impacted their quality of life, it was anxiety and fear over recurrence. And this proved to be very common, and it was denied. They denied it early in the diagnosis, but as time progressed, it went up 50% had moderate anxiety over this fear, and 15% significant fear of recurrence. So active surveillance, I don't think, is an ideal for the quality of life of our patients going forward. To propose active surveillance, you're going to have to downgrade it. You're going to have to tell them that this is a good cancer to have. We can just watch it. And in a survey done, it shows that almost a third of the patients find that that good cancer to have downplayed their diagnosis. They weren't being taken seriously, and they really felt that the it was invalidating the cancer burden that they were suffering. So surgical treatment is what you need to do for this patient. And once again, the pendulum is swinging from total thyroidectomy to lobectomy. And there's many people in the audience that think that this is a new debate. But when I was a fellow, Orlo Clark and Blake Cady were debating this all the time. Orlo Clark said that 80 to 85% of patients, regardless of what you do, will do well. But we don't know how to identify the 15 that aren't. Blake Cady said a little bit more eloquently when he said, biology is king and patient selection is queen. So let's look at the advantages of doing a total thyroidectomy. So we have some survival benefit, decreased recurrence. You can use thyroglobulin for surveillance. You deal with the multifocal disease, which occurs in a third of our patients, and you're able to utilize radioactive iodine should this be deemed necessary. The advantages of doing a lobectomy, well, when we combined the SEERS database with the National Cancer Database, we found that overall survival was equal. And we eliminate the need for, eliminate the risk of hypoparathyroidism, it avoids radioactive iodine, and in a recent study by the Hong Kong group, they showed that lobectomy was much more cost-effective than a total thyroidectomy. Well, what are the disadvantages? I don't have to tell this group. Yes, with a total thyroidectomy, hypoparathyroidism. You're putting two nerves at risk. We upstage the patients, and when we upstage the patients, we're probably increasing the utilization of radioactive iodine. And they have to be on lifelong thyroid replacement. But what are the disadvantages of doing a lobectomy? Well, one nerve's at risk. And there's still patients that are going to require lifelong thyroid suppression or thyroid replacement. But there is, if we estimate, somewhere between 30 and 60% chance that a completion thyroidectomy may be needed. And we'll look a little bit at the quality of life. These are the ATA risk factors, low, intermediate, and high, extrathyroidal extension, vascular invasion. You're all familiar with those. And it is recommended that those that fall into the intermediate and high risk should undergo a completion or a total thyroidectomy. So people started applying these rules, these high-risk features, retrospectively. This is the Pittsburgh group, and they found 61% of their patients would have fallen into the higher intermediate risk group and would consider completion thyroidectomy. And the Hong Kong group did a similar study and found that it was up to 43% of patients. So the high-risk histological features are very hard to predict perioperatively. So you have to remember, if you're doing the lobectomy, that you have to counsel your patient there may be a completion thyroidectomy required. Finally, what is it that the patients want? And I thought this was a great study by our Australian colleagues, and they surveyed over 2,000 patients, and 2,000 non-thyroid cancer patients, and educated them, would you take a total thyroidectomy, a lobectomy, or active surveillance? And they asked, what is it that you want? And not surprising, decrease follow-up, decrease out-of-pocket cost, a decrease in voice and calcium issues, and they wanted a decreased risk of developing invasive cancer and a decreased mortality. Interesting, there was a heightened risk of acceptance if the term cancer was used versus a thyroid lesion. And those patients that had a lower health literacy also had a heightened risk for taking a higher risk option. Cancer, when cancer was used, lower preference to active surveillance. When a lesion was used, a higher prevalence of lobectomy versus total thyroidectomy. And this just tells me there's a piece of educating our patients, but it's also how you frame the discussion. So in summary, surgery is the only cure, and yes, lobectomy has a safer profile, but you must manage your patient's expectations and recognize a higher incidence of completion thyroidectomy. It's all how you frame the discussion. It's all what happens to them after they're postoperative and they go into the cancer center with the endocrinologist. So patient selection remains key, and this is a multidisciplinary management issue. So now I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Morris to discuss active surveillance.
Thank you, Dr. Pasika. Always very intimidating to have to come after Dr. Pasika. So do all thyroid cancers need to be treated? I have no disclosures. I do want to make an admission. A little unusual admission for a debate like this, which is that I actually think that everything Dr. Pasika said is very defensible. There's actually more than one right answer for this patient that we're discussing with a small papillary thyroid cancer. But really, this is the privilege that we have, the joy that we have of being a surgeon is to help patients weigh the risks and benefits of an operation. And what I was hoping to hear from Dr. Pasika was not only that surgery is good, because we're all surgeons and we believe that and we know that, but also that immediate surgery is necessary and this patient needs surgery next week. Why is that? Well, helping patients navigate this is what is so rewarding about being a surgeon. But if you've been following the last 10 years of how our thinking about thyroid cancer has evolved, Dr. Pasika covered much of this very nicely. One thing that's clear is that we now recognize that more is not better. And just because we make a high-quality product and can apply it safely does not mean that we need to slather it all over every hot dog that walks in the door. Okay? And if you, as a surgeon, can get your patient to the same longevity and quality of life and enjoyment of their life and overall health without doing an operation, then I would argue you're truly a great surgeon if you can select that patient. So the first point that I want to make for you all is that most small thyroid cancers do not actually need to be discovered. And what I mean by do not need to be discovered is that if they were not discovered, they would not go on to cause symptoms or harm or death, certainly, for that patient. This is a term that the epidemiologists use overdiagnosis for. A cancer that did not require treatment because it would not have gone on to cause a problem for that patient. And when I say that most cancers in the thyroid are overdiagnosed, I mean 70%, as was shown nicely in a New England Journal paper last year. So 70% of these cancers that we find don't need to be found. And if you think about it, this kind of makes sense. It turns out that papillary thyroid cancer is essentially a normal finding. If you look at autopsy studies of normal appearing thyroid glands in people who didn't have thyroid disease, 30 to 40% of those thyroid glands have papillary thyroid cancer in them. 30 to 40% of the people in this room have a small papillary thyroid cancer. Don't go get an ultrasound out in the exhibit hall if they offer you one. I wouldn't recommend it. And this has been replicated in countless autopsy studies. This number is somewhere between 5 and 40%. 1,000 unrecognized subclinical cancers for every one that we actually detect. And 50 to 100 million Americans with an occult papillary thyroid cancer. Now, this is great news in some ways, right? Because I see my fellow sitting in the middle of the room here, and he's about to start a career as an endocrine surgeon. Great news, 50 to 100 million people we can operate on. But actually, it's really great news because these are 50 to 100 million Americans with untreated PTC. We already know the natural history of untreated PTC because it's walking around us. And the majority of these patients, 99% of them, never have their PTC come to clinical attention, and they live healthy lives. Now, how do we find these PTCs? Well, as we look harder, we find more of them, right? So as your primary care physician orders an ultrasound for nonspecific symptoms like a sore throat or fatigue or hair loss or weight gain, a needle can be put into any irregularity that's found in the thyroid quite easily. I actually know, Dr. Pasika, how this patient had her thyroid cancer picked up because I read about it in the paper. Non-thyroid related imaging. So a crackhead mugger nearly choked a woman to death in the vestibule of her Harlem building last fall, but wound up saving her life. Right, so we know that many patients have their thyroid cancers picked up on a non-thyroid directed imaging test, incidentally. In this case, a CT scan of the neck that led to a finding of a small irregularity in the thyroid gland, which was biopsied and was papillary thyroid cancer. And she believes that her life was saved because that thyroid cancer was found. And the harder we look, the more of these that we find. So we've seen a tripling in the incidence of papillary thyroid cancer in this country in the last 40 years, which is very dramatic. But I want to mention an even more extreme example of that. What if you looked even harder than we're accidentally looking for thyroid cancer? Well, this is what's happened in South Korea in the short span of 10 years. So, amazingly, with just 1 in 8 adults in Korea being screened for thyroid cancer as part of a health checkup, we find a ton of those occult, those subclinical papillary thyroid cancers. And the harder you look, the more of them you find. That increase that I showed you in the U.S. pales in comparison with this epidemic of thyroid cancer in Korea. And this is truly what has been called an epidemic of diagnosis, not an epidemic of actual disease. But here's the thing, despite all of this extra diagnosis, the extra anxiety, the extra surgery, the extra radioactive iodine, mortality in Korea and in the United States has not gone down. We haven't saved any lives despite all of the extra surgery that we're doing and all the extra treatment that we're delivering. So that sounds great at the ACS meeting. That sounds great in this very, big room. And that's science, right? But what's the practicality of this? Well, the practicality is that before that patient got to your office, this is what they were told. And there's some celebration that goes along with this, right? The physician who found and worked up that small thyroid lesion believes that it's great, and the patient believes that it's great that it was found. And there's high-fiving going on in the office. I did the hard work of finding your cancer. I'm just going to send you to a surgeon, and they're going to do the technical job of taking your thyroid out. No big deal. But in reality, this is the anxiety and the background that patients come to our offices with. It's real. And we have to be aware of this. As surgeons, we need to be able to build a therapeutic relationship with our patients who have been told this and given this anxiety and a feeling of urgency that they need surgery right away. And this is where I think our jobs are indispensable, because unlike the other physicians before us, we understand the risks and benefits of thyroid surgery. That endocrinologist is not on the hook if the patient has a complication, but we are, and more accurately, the patient is. So all of that workup turned a healthy person into a sick patient. And if there's anything that doesn't go perfectly with their treatment, whether it's the scar, the neck stiffness, more complicated issues, quality of life issues, that's all borne by the patient. That's where it is incredibly important that we as surgeons understand the options that the patient has. because these risks of complications, this is the Korean data from insurance claims, and insurance claims don't lie, whereas retrospective analyses of a surgeon's practice might. But these are the complications that we see. And if that surgery is necessary, these complications are totally acceptable, right? They're low. However, if that surgery was not maybe truly necessary or beneficial to the patient, I would argue that these complications or any complications are unacceptable. They're borne by the patient for the rest of their life, but really by us too, because we lose sleep over complications in a patient where in our heart of hearts, we wonder whether that surgery really helped them when we know that it might have hurt them. So that's my next point here, that small papillary thyroid cancers do not require surgery immediately, and most of them never will. So years ago in the 1990s, Dr. Miyauchi, Dr. Ito, Dr. Sugitani in Kobe and Tokyo began to realize that a lot of the surgery they were doing was just creating harm without benefit, and they began to offer their patients with small papillary thyroid cancers active surveillance, which is vigilant observation. And if the cancer were to grow, they would then go ahead and do a lobectomy or a total thyroidectomy, depending. At 10 years, only 8% of these thyroid cancers actually grew. And this is an important fact because it allows us to risk stratify that patient. It allows us to let the passage of time under close observation tell us, the surgeon, who might benefit from surgery and who is unlikely to benefit from surgery. So think of active surveillance as a risk stratification scheme. You're using the passage of time and the collection of data to help pick the patient who's going to benefit most from your operation. Active surveillance is not a you don't need surgery, you're wasting my time, you don't have to see me again. It's you're my patient, this is the next step in treatment for you, and we can always do that surgery at a later date if it becomes necessary, but it might not become necessary. So at my center, which is Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York, we're a little late to the game behind the Japanese, but we have also been offering active surveillance for intrathyroidal papillary cancers up to 2 centimeters in size. We've been doing this for about 7 years under the leadership of Mike Tuttle from our endocrinology group. We now have a little over 300 patients. This was our recent report. But similar to the Japanese study, a small percentage of these thyroid cancers grow. A small percentage gets smaller. It's actually slightly more that gets smaller than grow. But the vast majority of them just sit there. They don't change, which is what we know because 50 to 100 million Americans have a small indolent thyroid cancer. Now, at 5 years' time, we see that about 12% of these cancers grow. The one caveat I'll give you, as Dr. Pasika mentioned, is that younger patients do have a slightly higher probability that they'll hit that growth threshold at some point. So it's about 20, 25% in our experience. But this is now part of the ATA guidelines, okay? So active surveillance can be considered as an alternative to immediate surgery in a very low-risk tumor or patients who have comorbid conditions or other competing risks. In other words, this is an option within the standard of care. This is not experimental. This is within the standard of care of treatment for this patient. So there's more than one right answer. I hope I've convinced you that as a surgeon, you play a special role here that the other physicians don't. You get to help the patient weigh the risks and benefits. These are both options that you should be comfortable with if you do thyroid surgery. And I think that if both options are acceptable, the best next step for this patient is a delayed surgery approach or a deferred surgery approach. We don't need to do surgery right now. We're going to watch you closely. And the surgery that you might need can be done at any time. It doesn't need to be done next week. This is my final slide. So let's keep an eye on this and make sure it doesn't turn into a major lawsuit. So if you and your patient decide, yeah, surgery is the way I want to go here, I think that's fine. You need to pick the option with your patient that makes the most sense for them. But make sure that you've discussed active surveillance as an alternative to surgery with that patient. The last thing you need is for them to be one of the small percentage of patients who has a complication or is some way unhappy with their surgical result and says, gosh, that doc never told me about active surveillance. If she had told me about it, I would have taken her up on it. So discuss all options with your patients as honestly as you can. Help them pick the best solution. Thank you so much.
So if people want to come up to the microphone, if they have questions or comments, that'd be great. But while we're waiting for that, thank you, Dr. Morris and Dr. Pasika. So I wonder, so Dr. Pasika, do you have anything to say in response first?
So how many people would do a total thyroidectomy on this patient? How many people would do a unilateral lobectomy? And how many people would consider active surveillance?
And how many of you feel like you've changed your mind?
I have nothing further to say.
How many of you feel like you've changed your mind as a result of this talk? That's super. Yeah. Excellent. Yes, first person at the front or back microphone.
I'll defer to.
If you can say where you're from, that'd be great too.
Cord Sturgeon from Chicago.
Oh,
yeah, I heard.
Dr. Sturgeon.
Hello. In my practice, I do not have the time or the resources to run an active surveillance program. In fact, if I decided to be the primary driver of active surveillance, pretty quickly I would stop operating because I'd have no time for new patients. So I'm curious if any of you actually run an active surveillance program and how that works. But I think the real thing to address here is not what do we do with 4-millimeter PTCs that come in the office. It's how do we make it so that they never get diagnosed in the first place. In my practice, and I'm in Cook County where litigation is king, radiologists will recommend all sorts of things that we probably shouldn't do. You know, here there's a 4-millimeter, 5-millimeter thing, looks like a PTC, biopsy is recommended. How do we stop them from doing that?
So it sounds like there's two questions. Maybe let's take the first one. So Dr. Wong or Dr. Morris, do both of you want to talk a little bit about how the active surveillance program works at your institution? Dr. Morris?
So Dr. Sturgeon, that's a great point. You need a multidisciplinary buddy to take care of these patients. When I first started talking to patients about this, I thought it would be a really long conversation. Our high maintenance Upper East Side of Manhattan patients, when you talk to them about active surveillance, they are relieved that they don't need surgery. But again, I don't say you don't need surgery ever. I don't say you're wasting my time. I got sick people out there. I say, I don't yet have enough reason to tell you need surgery now, but we're gonna keep a close eye on you. And we can always do the surgery later. And people are relieved to hear that. Almost every time, I find that the anxiety is real, and a few minutes of an encapsulation of what we talked about today really helps patients. So if your heart is in it, they will understand that you're not worried, and they won't be worried. It's worth a couple of minutes. So that is an investment in time, but it's not that much. And Dr. Wong and I do this routinely, and it doesn't mess up our clinic schedules. In terms of following them, I find it useful to work with an endocrinologist who understands active surveillance. You should all find one in your communities. I will see the patient once a year, and the endocrinologist will see the patient once a year. So they're seeing one of us every 6 months with an ultrasound. And then we space that out to every year after the first 2 years. They're usually quick visits. The patients are happy to get in and out.
I think that's good.
Yeah.
And I would just add, just so we can at least answer Dr. Sturgeon's second question about talking to radiologists, if anyone isn't aware of this, there is a white paper from the American College of Radiology that does make recommendations about how to interpret ultrasounds and when to recommend biopsy and when not to of thyroid nodules and incidental findings on other imaging studies, if that's a
Dr. Sturgeon, don't feel compelled to operate because someone biopsied something. That's where we come in, right? We get to help patients interpret that data.
Right. They just would never be in an observation protocol if they never had that biopsy. That's what I was thinking.
That's right. So a person at the front microphone. I think we just have, unfortunately, just time for one more question. So tell us your name and your question.
Gary Nabnett, New York, Mount Sinai. My experience is very different an Upper East Side practice in that you work at a cancer center and patients come to Memorial Sloan Kettering with a diagnosis of cancer. But when we offer surveillance, which we do routinely to patients, there is a human factor to the anxiety of having a cancer and trying to convince a patient to have watchful waiting for a 5-millimeter papillary cancer that was perhaps should not have been biopsied does add a component to the decision making. So that was one point I wanted to make. And secondly, there are two factors also that are very important when deciding whether to operate and the extent of surgery. And number one is ultrasound examination. And I think surgeon-performed ultrasound cannot be overemphasized, the importance of doing that. You can actually share images with the patient, have them participate in the decision-making. Nodule location, is it abutting the insertion site of the recurrent nerve? Is it have posterior effacement? Is there invasion, et cetera? Can all be gathered to increase your index of suspicion about the biological behavior of a small papillary cancer. And having the patient participate in that decision making is very rewarding. And then even if you do have a bad outcome during surgery, God forbid, the patient has participated in that decision making and you're much likely to end up in litigation. And the second point is molecular profiling. I think there is a lot we don't understand about molecular markers, but I do think that will play a very important role in the future as we begin to drill down and have the ability to further personalize decision making for the benefit of patients. So I don't really have a question. That was more of a comment on your excellent presentations. Thank you.
So thanks for bringing that up. So just other members on the panel, does anyone have any other phrasing that they like to use that helps foster the discussion with the patient about active surveillance that they'd like to share? Dr. Morris talked about the concept of maybe you don't need surgery now. Are there any other ideas or concepts that you guys use?
I talk about that, if we didn't have the technology to pick this up, you may have gone for many, many years before it got to a level that we could actually palpate it. I think you do have to spend some time initially with the patient to get a sense of their anxiety level. And I would say that I never want to necessarily, if they have a thought of that they want to consider active surveillance, we do have a program. They then go to one of our endocrinologists. And then they are free to come back to my clinic if they then decide for the surgery. So we have sort of put it as a tag team. But I agree with Cord that I couldn't be doing all of the active surveillance, but our endocrinologists have allowed us. But I like it that I can see the patient first to have that discussion.
Yeah, I think those are great points. And actually, unfortunately, we have to move on, but we can duke it out at the front at the end.